They say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole we found.
Get ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
Okay, folks, welcome back in for the second half of the Verizon Data Breach Report with Gabe Bassett and James, myself. We're going to continue taking this take. Like, if you remember, the first half of this was kind of spent on the first five or six pages. I think we talked a ton of that through. And we ended with this this notion of internal versus external, financially motivated over espionage, espionage being pointed in the public sector. And Gabe, you hinted that you were going to go into patching, and I got all excited. I said, wait, hold on, let's hold that for the second half. So I think a great place to start this one, this particular segment is, as we go in the second half of this hour here, this stat, 56% take, quote, months or longer to discover in breaches. How is that possible? It's 2019. Why are we still terrible at detecting these?
Now, that is a question. Because
I figure I'd start it easy.
Yep. Why are we terrible at detecting them? And you know, it's the question that we are terrible, right? Because on the one hand, like, I've had people suggest, hey, it looks like we're getting better because, you know, the months is going down. On the other hand, you know, one of the other people on the report was saying, hey, they saw, you know, a news article about a breach where, like, the attackers were in the network for a week before being detected. You know, and we're like, man, that's actually really good. On the other hand, this stat is a really interesting one when we talk about discovery time, because there's a lot of confounding pieces to it. The first is that it's always worse than it looks, because the reality is that if a breach occurred in 2017 or 2018, we'll go with 2018, it occurred in 2018, and it takes years to discover, it's not going to make it into the 2019 report, right? Because it hasn't been discovered yet. It's only going to get counted against, you know, the 2018 breaches once it's discovered, and that's going to happen sometime this year. It'll be in the 2020 report. And so the years and months always goes up as a percentage after the next report comes out. And so it's always worse than it initially looks. On the other hand, there's some room for optimism because, you know, like we started off talking about in the first podcast with, we were talking about, you know, what we include in the report. And we only include, you know, compromises of confidentiality, integrity, or availability. And so we have a selection bias. And so if you have a breach that was kind of starting and you detected it before it really became a compromise worth reporting, you probably don't make it into our report. And so, you know, there's an alternate potential explanation and maybe a bias in our data, and that, you know, maybe if you detect the breach in seconds or minutes or hours, it never becomes a breach. If it doesn't become a breach, it never shows up in our report. And so our numbers will always look bad because the people that are stopping breaches don't show up in our report.
Well, okay. I guess that's fair.
Is that deep?
That's deep and profound, but I mean, look, okay. So that comment, it's always worse than it seems, that you made is kind of troubling, but on the whole, if we're taking, what was the time? It was like over 190 days at first. Like, we're almost at a year at one point, and then we're down to like 6 months, and now we're down to a few months. I mean, I guess that's better. But you guys also mix together all kinds of detection, including like fraud, from what I read, and account. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that go into this. So detection isn't just finding when an exploit was used or when an attacker, you know, popped a shell, right?
Exactly. And that's kind of the third bias in the data is it's going to be driven a lot by the types of breaches that occurred. You know, if there's a lot of point of sale breaches are generally detected or at least reported due to common point of presence, right? The credit card company notices a bunch of compromises associated with credit cards and tracks back to say, where were they all used in the same place? And then that data is used to go and say, well, this place must have been breached. And that's going to take some time. Ransomware, on the other hand, the detection is very quick. Because, you know, the first step to paying a ransom is knowing that you've been you've suffered from ransomware. And so the attackers tell you. More so, an error may take a long time to discover because, you know, who knows how long it was sitting out there before someone looked and saw it. On the other hand, an error may be very quick because you sent it was an auto mailer that got off by one. And so you send person A's information to person B and person B's information to person C. And so a lot of discovery time is going to be driven by the types of breaches that occurred, not necessarily that all kind of all inclusive. Here is how quickly organizations are internally detecting breaches. And give this just 1 second. I can actually go back and could look at for a discovery, see what the discovery times are for internal. When it's discovery is internal, if you'd like.
Yeah,
I just need to look it up.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so while you look that up, I mean, I think that the hardest part of detecting any of these things is, you know, that if they're the data, the different types of breaches, the different types of incidents that occur, like you said, some of them are super obvious. Some of them are nuanced. That, you know, that don't get detected until somebody actually, like, somebody takes some data and you don't, or takes a credit card or something, and you don't find out about it until they use it. Could be a week, a month, a year, or plus later. So it's an interesting topic, certainly. But I'm kind of curious now what you're going to pull up there, because always interesting to have some good real time.
Yeah, and so one of the things we track is not just we don't just track the units, but we also track the discovery method. So how is the breach discovered? And so we look at both, was it discovered internally? Was it discovered externally or by a partner? In our case, like partner might be a company that you've paid to monitor your systems. And so if you've got a service or something, that would fall into partner discovery. Mm-hmm. Give me a second because I'm trying to decide what the best way to look at this is. Okay, I got it here. And so when we look at how internal versus external discovery affects the timeline, one thing that stands out substantially is that external discovery is almost half in months, right? And then far more than internal discovery. Internal discovery is a little over 25% months. And then in years, external discovery is about 12%, while internal is below about, you know, 6 or 7%. And so external discovery, and I mean, this makes sense inherently, but external discovery is going to lead to longer discoveries. On the other hand, internal discovery leads to much shorter. It's days or weeks or hours, and is much more common. Days, weeks, and hours are much more common in internal discovery. And so this can lead to kind of a goal for organizations. Try to focus your discovery on what can I do to discover this breach internally versus externally? Because even though external discovery may come in months or years, you can be almost assured that if someone's discovering it externally, there's no time for you to do anything about it. Like that, yeah, the horse is out. Like you're now in post-breach actions. Well, if you discover internally, you know, there's an opportunity for you to do something. Maybe, you know, in fact, there's almost no minutes discovery. And externally, it's all internal. And so use that opportunity and say, what can I do to discover in minutes or hours or days versus weeks or months or years?
That is interesting. So, okay. But I guess I'm still stuck on the holy crap, it still takes months to discover. Do you have any metrics on or hard data on when it comes down to a non, I want to word this, kind of a non-obvious, not like a, you know, where it encrypts your entire network, but one of these like actual data exfiltrations, the average time it takes to detect stolen data or a threat actor in the actual network just rummaging around?
I mean, that would depend how we describe it. Like, we can remove breaches that are due to errors.
So I guess that kind of goes, that go dovetails into another thing I want to talk about, but and we'll talk about in just a second, but and that's that, how many steps it takes to get from I'm in to I'm done, right? Yeah. In terms of capturing data and taking that exfiltration. But real quick first, something that was no surprise to me, servers are still the biggest target in general. I mean, that's, you know, it's like that misattributed code of, that's where, you know, why do you rob banks? Where the money is. Yeah. Why do you attack servers? Where the data is. That's, I mean, but the person the attack on the individual person is on the rise, which is interesting at 39%.
Yeah, and so, and when you think about servers, you know, the attacks on servers are not necessarily exploiting the servers, but they're the asset involved. And so, you know, the asset involved in the compromise of credentials, right, is going to be a server. And this goes back into some of the web app discussions, the cloud discussions, right? And so a server, yep, where someone uses credentials, and those, because those don't really feel like mentally what we think about as a breach of a server. Because if I said, hey, my server was breached, you know, most people would think about it be an exploit being run or a vulnerability being taken advantage of. And certainly that happens. If you have known vulnerabilities exposed on the internet, they're going to be found. If they're easy to exploit, they're going to be exploited. On the other hand, the attackers, we're all kind of familiar with credential stuffing, where attackers, you know, build up these huge login and password lists and try them against everything on the internet, whether it be a financial institution, a cloud service, a retail, your company. We know that that's occurring, and that is an incredibly easy way for people to get in, right? You buy a list of credentials and you just keep trying until you're in. You know, that's a computer that sits off in the corner that's doing its thing, and you know, you don't have to actually bother with. And phishing is the same way. You know, you get a list of email addresses and you rack up the email you send, and you send on a file. You send on a Office document with a macro in it, and it says, hey, would you run this macro? And, you know, we've trained our people to say no, but there's someone that's going to go, I don't know what a macro is, but I really want to see what's in this document. Click. You know, or sends in, you can send executables. Like, and it may not be called an executable, right? There's a lot of forms that executables take, and there's a lot of ways to not call them an executable when you send them, but it's an executable. And you send that to people, and you're like, hey, will you run this thing? And they're like, sure, click. And so the reality is that there's always going to be someone within the organization that's going to click. We've seen a huge decrease, right, in click-through rates in sanctioned phishing tests. It used to be, I think, 24% 7 years ago, and now it's down to like 3%. But the reality is there's a lot of fish in the sea, like we talked about. And yeah, even if 99.9% of them are smart fish, that last 0.1% is enough to keep the people fishing happy.
Well, I think we said this already, but I think every data breach report Verizon has published since inception has been a giant ad for two-factor authentication. Like, if we're talking about credentials here, which is the target, like, why isn't everybody using two-factor authentication on your critical stuff, for crying out loud?
Oh, so the first year I presented the DBR, the first year I was on the team was presenting the DBR. I went into my first presentation, and I said, you know, y'all, if you haven't enabled two-factor authentication, this is the year you have to enable two-factor authentication. And I stand by that. The first year I briefed the DBR was the year you should have enabled two-factor authentication, like 4 or 5 years ago. Like, at this point, you are behind the curve if you've not enabled two-factor authentication. I have a, you know, little file server that I have here at home, and it's got a little web interface, and I can enable two-factor authentication there, right? I have two-factor authentication on my little home system. In a lot of cases, it's an easy thing. And we say easy, right? Like, as if, you know, because we're not the ones that necessarily have to do it. Someone is going to actually manage that. And if it's a small organization, it's some guy who's trying to handle every piece of IT on their own and looks at that little, even if it's just clicking a box, looks at that box and goes, man, if I click this, I'm going to have to take support calls from every single person in this organization monthly to reset this thing. You know, it's a challenge. And if you're a big organization, you look at that and you say, you know, I want to enable two-factor authentication on the VPN gateway, but, you know, that was set up 5 years before I joined this company. The guy, no one even remembers who set it up anymore. It works. And if we were to ever break it, it would disrupt literally everything. And so conceptually, I know that I should be doing this and it should be easy, but am I really willing to take that risk? Like, it's not, it's none of the things that security suggests are ever as easy in practice as they are in theory. In fact, there's a great quote. In theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, and in practice, there is. And it's something to always keep in mind for security practitioners that, you know, it's very easy for us to discuss things in theory. In practice, it's much harder.
Well, and then, you know, you add on to that, you know, something is what we, you know, high level in theory would say two-factor authentication. I mean, it's pretty easy to implement. Then how do you implement it? You know, do you do it through SMS and then get blasted by everybody? Do you, you know, use an authenticator app? Do you push notification? You know, I mean,
yeah,
there's so many ways to do it. And then, you know, how do you know which is the right way in your situation? I think that is kind of an interesting point to think about. It's also interesting to look at. You know, we see stolen credentials all the time as being a way to get in. I mean, are we seeing less vulnerabilities like in apps, like, or, you know, like SQL injection, that type of stuff, as far as the exploit path? Or, you know, because I'm always curious. I mean, on here, I think one of the things it shows, like, SQL injection is pretty low down.
Yeah. And I was looking up SQL injection the other day, and, you know, it looks, yeah, certainly we've seen a drop, though last year we saw a substantial increase. Like, looking at percentages, in 2015, it was, I think, 2.5% of action varieties. In 2016, 1.5. And then it went up in 17 to 3%. And last year it was up at like almost, it was getting towards 7%. And then now it's back down to, you know, 1.5%. And so it's not unprecedented of that, you know, the percentage it's at. But it's also not high. And we generally don't see that in the report. We see exploiting vulnerabilities in the single digits. In fact, this year, at most, 6% of breaches involved exploiting a vulnerability.
And hold on. Stop. Yeah. Stop right there. At most 6%. Okay. Yeah. That somewhere, because I know my head exploded the first time you told me that, because I'm thinking, like, it's got to be higher. That can't possibly be right. Only less than 6%? At most 6%? Really?
Yeah, I think the median is actually like 3%.
Explain that.
Yeah, and this goes back to an overarching theme for the report, that the attackers want the shortest, easiest path. And, you know, and remember, a lot of times in the report, the things that get in the report are not the, you know, I exploit this vulnerability on every host on the entire internet, right? We talked at the beginning about how we filtered out botnet stuff, which isn't really exploiting a vulnerability, but we also filtered out those secondary web app exploits, which are, you know, notionally exploiting a vulnerability. And so a lot of that shotgunning the internet stuff, like we talked about in the first podcast or the first half of this one, you know, if you've got known vulnerabilities that have been around forever exposed to the internet, you know, go close those, please. But then when it comes down to it, the easy path for the attackers is not to go exploit a vulnerability. It's not to go and write some advanced code or even to run advanced code. Like, it's to do the easy thing. It's to just straight up ask for the money. It's to, yeah, I know, like,
right, well,
I just look at that and it's like, you know what? This is a really easy way to make money, to ask for it.
Right. I mean, well, if you think about it, you know, I mean, I could get access to a web application and search around and hunt and try to find a SQL injection flaw or some other flaw, or I could just buy a list of stolen credentials.
Exactly.
Right. And you know? I mean, you know, so is that, you know, that path of least resistance? I mean, is this kind of that cycle that it's just, you know, it's not, you know, as worth it unless it's a really targeted attack. You know, I want that kind of zero cost. Hey, let me just go get credentials and try it. That's way more effective for me than actually trying to, you know, find vulnerabilities within an application.
Exactly. Even like the ransomware things, and even like, so this is a real, this one blow your mind. We talked a little bit about espionage. You know what starts most espionage attacks? Phishing. It's not like exploiting some zero-day vulnerability. Even the espionage guys start with phishing because, you know, why should they go through all the work if the easy thing's going to work, right?
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Does that bring us finally into the patching discussion, guys?
Yeah, it's a good place to talk about it. And it's a good place to talk about both patching on kind of page 11 as well as in Appendix C. And so one of the things we looked at this year is we looked at patch data. And this year we took a little bit different approach to how we normalize it. In the DBR and everywhere in our report, our goal is to describe what the normal company, like the median company, would see. Right. And previously, when we've kind of looked at patch data, we took the median at each kind of point along that line. So what is, if you like it, each point in days, you know, 1 day, 2 day, 3 day, you know, what was the median at that point? But what we found was that was kind of giving companies that had more vulnerabilities a little bit more weight. And so this year we said, okay, if your organization, and we don't know who these organizations are, we just know how many vulnerabilities were attributed to each. And so we said, okay, if you have 1,000 vulnerabilities in your organization, each one of your vulnerabilities is going to count for 1/1,000th of weight, which means that every individual organization, whether large or small, counts equally. You know, it's offered an equal weight into the system. And then we then took and said, okay, how does the patch rate improve over time? And, you know, so this gives a little bit more relative weight to small organizations with not as many systems or not as many vulnerabilities. But we found was a little bit lower rate, right? The patch rate was about less than 50%, and kind of a gradual increase versus, you know, a big jump up. There is that big jump at the beginning, right? It starts at, you know, 18-20%, just eyeballing it. And that's things get patched before their first scan, right? They discover that it's vulnerable, and then they're patched before the second scan.
I love that quote on top of page 11, folks. If you haven't read this, if you are long-term relationship, married, formerly married, all the above, you will appreciate this because it says, based on scan history, we determine that organizations will typically have a big push to remediate findings after they are initially discovered, which you just said, and after they are and a steady increase in percentage of findings fixed until it levels out. Here's a genius. Not unlike the amount of romance and mutual regard that occurs while dating versus once married. You get the idea.
Yeah, Dave Highlander can take credit for
Dave.
That joke.
Dave, I need to have you on the show. Team. I need to have you on the show just to give us a comedy and humor backline of this because that is just brilliant. I mean, it's true, but it's brilliant. I love the analogy.
But a good thing. Oh, go ahead.
No. So it makes sense, right? And it's something we all suspect is that the vulnerability comes out, it makes the news, it gets its own, you know, tagline, graphic, website, theme song, Twitter trending hashtag, and by the time people start noticing, it's gone. Like, we notice and it becomes part of the everyday, we move on to the next thing, we forget about patching it. So what's the number in your experience? What's the number of – what's the percentage – is it like a – and you might not have this data, but I'm always curious, like, what's the percentage that you could say that the organization gives up on once it reaches, like, a couple of jobs ago, it used to be 82%. Like, if we could reach 82%, we were like, we're done. Like, we're not going to get any better.
See, I don't necessarily think it's a percentage as much as it's a point in time. And this is some analysis we did when we looked at vulnerabilities a year or two ago. There's this very big cutoff where once you get to, like, I think it's about 90 days, it's about a quarter.
Yeah.
Like, patching just stops. If it doesn't get patched in a quarter, it probably doesn't get patched for at least another year or two. I think it was like 2 years, actually. And so I think that it's less like a goal of hitting a percentage as hitting individual patch cycles.
Well, if I'm going by that graph in the bottom of page 11, bottom left-hand corner of page 11, yeah, the area AUC, the what they call area under curve, right? Yeah. That's the percentage of the findings that have been fixed at the 90-day mark shows 32.4%.
Like, so that would be completion on time. Like, and the, so the end of the line at 90 days is about 44%. But one of the things we want people to think about is how quickly do you patch in that time? And so if you look, like, if you take that line, it just divides the area above it and below it. Only 30% of that graph is below it. And what we want it to be is 100%. Like, we want the little blue line to go, like, straight up,
yeah,
about 7 days, and then just go right across the very top of this.
Yeah, which
and
it so, doesn't.
Yeah, and we want organizations to think a little bit about, okay, even if I am getting, let's say you're in a good organization, you're getting to that 80 or 90% patch rate at 90 days. Well, did you do it all in like the last week? And so, you know, if you'd measured it 80 days, your patch rate would have been 20%, or did you do it at 7 days? And so that you patch everything quickly. And the difference in there is high area under the curve. If you patch everything at 7 days, you're going to have a lot of area under that line. And your area under the curve is going to be really high. If you patched everything at 80 days, even though your patch rate at the end of the 90 days is going to be good, your area under the curve is going to be very bad.
Hmm. Got it. Okay.
Now, and there's a good thing to think about is going into Appendix C and thinking about what makes sense to patch. Right, because I think one of the reasons that things don't get patched is because they don't make sense, or, you know, maybe they're difficult, or, you know, are we really patching the right things? And there's organizations to help you with that. But one of the things we did is we looked at the difference between how often things were scanned for on the internet, so hits on honeypots, and how often the things existed on the internet, so internet scan data. And we looked at, like, the ratio. And the rank ratio. So the number one thing that is scanned for by attackers more often than it actually exists is Telnet.
Of course.
It's the number one thing attackers look for, and it's only the 15th most common port on the internet. And part of that is due to it being a login service, right? So you have to kind of hit it a couple times. But you go down the list in figure 66 on page 72, and you see things were kind of used to, right? We see port 445. We see 53413, which is one of those router vulnerable router ports. We see MySQL. We see Memcached. We see LDAP. And we see, you know, things that we can kind of start to see. And these are not new vulnerabilities, right? These are not things that came out a short while ago. The attackers are looking for things that have been around for forever because they're easy to attack. And it goes back to that whole narrative around the attackers want to attack easy things. On the other hand, if you go down a couple pages to page 74, you see kind of a comparison between the things that we find in vulnerability scans when we're, like, looking for our own vulnerabilities and the things attackers are looking for. And there's only a few things that attackers are looking for that are showing up at the top of our vulnerability scans. You know, it's like it's SSH, it's port 80 and 445, so web services, it's 123. A lot of the things we scan for and find are really not exciting to the attackers, right? Like, I like the port that's down in the lower left, port 8445. And, you know, you can just imagine that that's some random service, right, that someone set up at some internal tool or something that's got some vulnerability on it, right? You know, but no one really remembers who's maintaining it or, you know, how to patch it. Maybe the company's out of business that originally produced it. And so the question is, do you pay to patch that? It may be an expensive thing. It might be a rip and replace of the entire technology. You know, and I'd kind of say, you know, maybe that's not worth patching, because if the attackers aren't looking for it, is it really valuable to you to spend your resources doing this major project to fix it when you're spending nothing to address the 20% of breaches that were caused by errors, you know?
Well, I like the fact that there's a various port 8888 is often looked for. What's really weird is SQL Server 1433 is being scanned for quite a bit. I mean, I guess there's still a lot of SQL Server open. Dell Open Management's being
looked for.
Well,
remember, it's not about it being open. It's about the value to the attackers. Like, there doesn't have to be a lot of it open.
That's a good
a little
point.
Of it open may be great for the attackers.
Yeah. Hey, so look, let's kind of tag up this conversation and start kind of thinking about wrapping up around this area here. So the last couple pages of the where you talk about the different market segments, right? You got, if you look at accommodations, food and retail, educational services, financial services, healthcare, information industry, manufacturing, scientific, pro and tech services, public administration, and retail, those nine segments. I started reading through that, and I like the high level takeaway for me was, you can look at volume and you can look at disclosure to incident ratio, and the highest by far is accommodation and food service, so that's interesting. The one of the lowest ones is in financial services, but it's one of the highest volumes of incidents, and then you've got healthcare. It's got the 65%. High volume, high disclosure percentage, and you got public administration, 1% disclosure and 24,000 incidents. That's either miraculous or wrong.
No, so there's a lot of explanation that goes into this, and we talk about it in the report a little bit. The table is to give an idea of the sample sizes. I see we're kind of talking about table 2 on page 30.
Yeah.
It's to give an idea of how much insight we have into this industry, but it's not for comparison's sake, right? The reason we know a lot about public administration is not because they have more breaches than other organizations of their size. It's because they are very robust in their disclosure. And the reason you see the difference in ratios is because a lot of times they report even when they're not sure whether it was a breach or not. And so there's a lot of like, hey, you know, this might have been a breach, and so it's potential, right? But by our definition, it has to be confirmed disclosure. And so it falls in as an incident. And so the takeaway is that public administration is very good about cataloging not just breaches, but even potential breaches. Looking at someone like accommodation, even though there's a small number, right, those tend to be those point of sale breaches. Those tend to be very relevant. Healthcare has mandatory reporting. But also healthcare is required to treat even things that are potential as a breach. And so a lot of times
you're right,
that, you know, other organizations would just kind of, you know, brush under the rug, get disclosed as a breach. And even like small ones, right? Like, you know, you accidentally send person A's data to person B, and that becomes a disclosure like one time.
That's fair. That's
and so it's
that's,
not
that's
great
totally
to compare numbers, but it gives you some ideas about differences in the industries and how the different industries report. Because the reality is all the industries are probably suffering, particularly in air, is suffering from similar problems. It's just that the types of threats that maybe target the different industries change based on what they have.
Yeah. So what's the takeaway here? I mean, what as we wrap this conversation up, which could probably go for another hour plus, I think we'll probably do a follow up. As you said, you've got more data coming as well. But what's the wrap up? Like, what's the analysis here? Like, what's the big takeaway from this year?
So I think the big takeaway is whether it's the narrative around increasing targeting of executives with social attacks, or it's the switch from kind of card present to card not present breaches for payment information, or it's the path section. It's that the attackers in most cases want the cheap, easy, simple attack. And so as an organization, you need to choose, is my goal to stop the majority of attacks, and just say, look, you know, if we get attacked by that one threat that's willing to try plan B if plan A doesn't work, you know, we realize we're just going to have a really bad day. Or do I want to invest in doing that? Because for most organizations, it's going to be about investing and getting just that little bit above, right? We know that, you know, there's a dozen different ways to do two-factor authentication, and each one has, you know, imperfections. We know that there's protections against phishing, but the reality is there's always going to be someone that clicks. Every mitigation is imperfect, but if you can do that little bit, make that attack path just an extra step or two longer for the attacker, they have no reason to rise even the littlest iota to you when there's a dozen other targets that they don't have to do it to. And so, you know, choose, do I want to get just that little bit above and get above those nuisance threats, or do I want to invest that significant amount more where for a period you're not going to actually get any benefit on your investment, right? You're going to be getting better at security, but you're above the nuisance threats and still under the pivoting threats. And so you're not going to see a big return on investment there. But if you invest there, you get through that area and then you can start taking on the really advanced threats. And it makes sense if you're a big financial organization or a big IT services organization. It may not make sense if you're kind of a small mom and pop place.
Well, there's a ton of good folks. It like this conversation scratches the surface. There is a ton of good analysis in this sucker. I mean, this is 78 pages of the analysis, but you've got probably, you know, hours and hours of digging through this that I think folks could enjoy. How long did it take to put this together, Gabe?
So the report itself is a 6-month process, and the 6 months where we aren't working on the report is working on presentations about the report and working on the infrastructure to facilitate the report the next year. And so we have we started off the first podcast with, we have a dedicated team of 4 authors that works year round, basically just on this, and is head Holy down crap. On this for 6 months straight to make this happen. Ironically, the writing is the shortest part. It takes like 2 weeks to write. It takes 2 months to organize the partners, 2 months to collect the data and analyze it, 2 months to a month or two to, once we've got it written, rewrite it and edit it and clean it up and do the figures and do the fact checking and all the things to prepare for it. The writing takes like 2 weeks, and it has every year.
Of course. Interesting. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for joining us, James. That was awesome. Anything you want to leave off with?
Oh, I mean, there's so much info that's in there. I just recommend anybody that, you know, hasn't taken a look at it to go check it out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, folks, this has been a 2-parter of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast, episode 348 and 349 on the Verizon Data Breach Report with Gabriel Bassett from Verizon. Thanks for joining us. It has been a joy, as always, having you on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I had a great time.
All right. Awesome. Folks, go download this thing. Go read this thing. Go do your own analysis and learn from it. For crying out loud, turn on 2-factor authentication and start patching stuff. I think that'll – if we can change the impact to next year's report by doing some of that, that would be fantastic. And so for myself and James and Gabe here, thanks for listening, you guys. We'll catch you another time, another place on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Ciao, y'all.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.